So my academic background then is instead of going to do photography, I did anthropology, which is the study of, I suppose, humankind and cultures. And that's really given me a grounding in, I find people fascinating and I like telling stories and what have you. So I can actually trace a lot back to that. And from there, I went into journalism. And from journalism, I finally made the step into photography. And now I'm sort of mutating into this photographer, writer, broadcaster, video maker kind of entity that helps his clients tell their story through these media.
What kind of clients do you actually work with?
I'm finding that there's a lot to be done with food producers, either writing about them and helping them tell their story, or through photography, or through podcasting. There's a lot of ways that these companies, particularly small artisan food producers who are incredibly passionate about their food, have a story to tell, can get that story across and help them by telling the story through various media, connect with their target audience and draw them into their world. And you would hope then that they would ultimately become clients and buy the products. But first and foremost, it's telling the story of the food. And that's what I'm doing an awful lot at the moment.
You do a certain amount of professional work, mostly as a photographer and some of the other things that you do. Is there strategy is maybe not the most correct word, but in some ways it is. Is there some kind of overall thinking or strategy behind starting to share the stuff that you do online?
Yeah, it's kind of it's moved from I just want to share stuff, and I think you have to start from that perspective, because you have to, if you're going to go online and you're going to be writing or you're going to be showing people photographs or what have you, it's going to be about stuff that you're interested in and you just want to get it out and you just want to share it with people and you want to connect with people. But yes, I do. I mean, you asked about strategy, and I do have a strategy with the food, for instance. Now, I have a food blog, and that was started specifically with an aim to get me amidst food producers. And there's no commercial sort of selling on it of me, but I use it in the following way. It allows me to go to farmers markets and or it allows me to ring up food producers out of the blue and people who are connected with food and say, look, I'm really interested in what you're doing. And that's true. That genuinely comes from the heart. I have a very great interest in food and food producers. Can I write about you? Can I come and interview you? Can I see what you're doing so that I can put you on my blog? And what happens then is people, yeah, of course, they're only too happy for me to come along and to just show me what they do and to talk about what they do. And then I write about them, or I might do an audio recording, or I might I'm going to be doing some little videos as well. And I put that up on my blog. And gradually I get known as the guy who does this. So gradually what's happening is, and it might not be the person I've interviewed, I might not do any work for them. But what they are doing is they, because everybody talks to each other, of course, and then suddenly you're getting a phone call and somebody saying, listen, I spoke to this guy over here and he mentioned that you're doing this stuff and I actually need help with my website, or I need photographs, or I need text, or tell me a bit about podcasting. So the strategy of the blog is just to get me in there in a very easygoing sort of non-commercial way. Tell me about what you do. And gradually that gets me known in that sphere. And that's my strategy there.
Where do you think that line is? Because I certainly know from previous experience that it's very difficult to go from that line of saying, okay, I'll volunteer to do this and I'll do that, and then making that step to actually, having someone come along and say, well, I can pay you for doing this. How do you make that step?
The initial thing is it has to be very clear that the initial approach is from the heart, that there's no kind of commercial thing behind it. But, I do make it known that I take photographs professionally. I do make it known that I write professionally. So you're embedding that seed. I think as soon as you start going out and sort of too actively pushing it, then you're going to come off as a fraud, I think. But if you go out and you say, look, I'd really love to do this for you, I'm really interested in what it is that you're doing, please let me, in my particular case, please let me write about you because it will help me populate my blog and give me, you know, you might get a bit of exposure from it. And I also say to people, look, you know, if there's if you read the blog post and there's one or two pictures there that might benefit you, then by all means, please have them. And the reason I do that is it just creates that really relaxed kind of relationship building. And I'm a great believer that if you build relationships with people, then business will follow. And it might not follow, like I said before, from that person directly. It might not be them putting their hand in their pocket to pay you to do something, but it will be them suggesting you to somebody else. I'll give you a very concrete example. The very first blog post that I did with a food producer on my new food blog was with a really lovely couple who do mushrooms. And I did a little audio interview with them, and it's on Audioboo. And we had a chat about mushrooms and the health benefits and what have you. And then they got interviewed by a national newspaper, and the national newspaper needed a photograph. Well, this couple said, well, do you know what? We've just been interviewed by this guy. He's a photographer. He took a couple of photographs of our mushrooms. Why don't you speak to him? So then this national newspaper is ringing me up for a photograph. So that's a very concrete example of how that can work.
And what about finding material for the podcast? Where do you get ideas from?
If you're podcasting and you're doing it properly, you're doing it about something that you're interested in, you're passionate about. So you're going to be coming across material everywhere. You know, if I'm launching a new podcast about food, and all I need to do is go to a food market and or a farmer's market, and at every single stall, there's a story, there's something happening, there's, you know, there's ideas being presented to me. You just need to keep your eyes open and your ears peeled. And if you're passionate about something, you'll pick up these things anyway.
Let's talk a little bit about dynamic range. How heavily are you involved in that?
Hugely. The Dynamic Range video series is, there are three of us in the business. And it's the three guys who do the Circle of Confusion podcast. We produce this video series together. I'm the less visible partner because I don't actually appear on camera, but I'm the nominal director of the series. So I direct the other guys, and there are two of us behind the camera. We bring in a sound engineer, because the trick with video is not so much that the video looks good, it does help, but really what sets you apart is if you get your audio sorted out with video. So we learned very quickly from our pilot episode that we needed to bring in a sound engineer. So we found a student who was willing to work with us as an intern. And what a find he was. He was absolutely brilliant. So there's two of us behind the camera, me directing and doing the cinematography. And then there are the two guys, Peter and Neil, who present it. So that's the production phase. The pre-production phase I'm very heavily involved with, because I do the scripting. I do the kind of sort of mental mapping of what we're going to do. It's a consultative process as well. I mean, I'm not going to take 100% credit for that, but I do most of the heavy lifting in terms of the scripting. And then in the post-production part, I do some editing as well. And it depends on, say, for instance, the last episode was mainly edited by Peter, one of the presenters, but I would have gone in and helped out as well. So I'm involved in the post-production.
What was the decision to monetize that? You know, having gone to the website and looking at it, you kind of have to pay per episode. What's the kind of ideas and decisions behind that?
Well, the program was always intended to be monetized. And we just saw an opportunity. We thought we could produce a program that has a bit more of a European slant. There's a lot of good video content, and there's a lot of bad video content, but most of it is being produced in the States. So we saw an opportunity to produce maybe a more European centric educational video series about photography. So that's kind of where that came from. And it was always the intention to monetize it and to sell it.
How is that actually working? We live in this time now where if we want to find out about something, quite often the first place we go to is Google. And quite often the second place we go to is YouTube, because then you can see a video about how to do something. How do you kind of balance that against making that decision to to monetize a program like that? Because of course YouTube is free, and then you guys are monetizing a series of videos which is all about a specific subject. Where do you see the two sitting together?
It's a very good question. We do provide free content as well, so we will, for both of the full episodes, we've provided free segments. One was a segment from the first episode that actually is included in the first episode, and that was used as a marketing thing. So there's a whole 6-minute segment of photography tutorial and photography discussion available as a marketing effort, available through YouTube and available on the blog. The second video that we've got freely available is again an entire segment, and that's actually a segment we couldn't include. We just had too much material for the second episode. And rather than hold it over for the third episode, we thought, you know what, let's just give it away for free. I mean, A, it helps build that relationship with viewers. It shows them what the program is like, you know, it gives them a feel for what the program is. And it also allows us to do some marketing, because we can say to people, well, you know, you can try before you buy. As to monetizing it versus giving it away free, there is no way we could do this program for free, because there's actually quite a bit of investment goes into each episode. So we, you know, we need to recoup that. And a lot of the online material is either produced as part of a marketing thing. So, you know, there are fewer considerations around, you know, monetizing it. I mean, we're just three guys. We just set up a small mini company to allow us to produce this. But, you know, we have to somehow balance the books. So we have to monetize it.
Having done this for some time now, you know, you've gained quite a lot of experience, I think, in producing all kinds of media. If you could travel back in time and give yourself some advice from now when you first started, what would you say to yourself?
Do it sooner. Don't be an early adopter, be a first adopter. And I think it's taken me a while to learn that when it comes to building an audience, that there is that focus on building the community, build the following by giving great content for free, and don't try and monetize too soon. That would be the things I tell myself.
Building from Joanna Penn's example, we can identify that Roger started producing and sharing content from a need to promote his business and network with others in his profession. And by creating content in partnership with peers and mentors, promoting that content is shared. Roger promotes the content on his website and through social media. And the person he created the content with also promotes it through their channels, introducing Roger's content to potential new audience members. The constant creation of content shared from Roger's website also creates an ever-expanding library of content to be crawled and indexed by search engines. And the traffic generated by this content, combined with Roger's audience linking and sharing it, helps push Roger's website further and further up search engine rankings. This means that creating content collaboratively automatically creates an electronic relationship between the parties involved. However, what is clear from Roger's example is that a line needs to be drawn. Roger has chosen between what is free content and what content is monetized. If transmedia production, for the rest of us, is to become a business, or indeed is aimed at promoting a business, then some sort of communication model needs to exist to define exactly what type of content costs money and what type of content can be given away. An example of a company that's using electronic relationships effectively is Emergent Publishing. It's a company that formed in a chat room forum on Facebook, and as you'll hear in the following interview with the company's creative director, Jody Cleghorn, it's a company that specializes in producing works that use social media and other online collaboration tools as an integral part of the publishing process.
Let's start at the beginning, really. What's your background and kind of what led you to setting up Emergent?
My background is actually as a writer. So I sort of stumbled through, you know, almost 20 years of my life doing, you know, crappy, menial, often bizarre jobs because I only ever wanted to write. And then when my son was born 8 years ago, I took over the editorship of a magazine and did that for 3 years. So I came out of magazine editing to go back to writing. And then within 6 weeks, started being filled with ideas and very quickly realized that the ideas that I was having, I was never going to be able to pitch to a publishing house. I was looking at doing collaborative work with multiple writers. So I had the idea for an interconnected short story anthology, which went on to become the Red Book. And it was just a matter of right time, right people, right place, right platform. Emergent was actually conceived on Facebook's chat just after they launched the chat platform. I ran into Paul Anderson, who I knew through Write Anything, and said, look, I've got this nutty idea. Do you think it's crazy enough to work? Told him what the idea was, and he said, yes, I think it's crazy enough to work. I said, do you want to come and work on it with me? And he said, yes. And sort of 10 days later, we'd kind of brainstormed this kind of amazing digital platform that ironically looks a lot like Etherbooks. But neither of us had the technical expertise to be able to create a platform like that. And after about 6 months of kind of floundering and our ideas going nowhere, I sort of said to Paul, look, I think we need to go back to that interconnected short story idea, and sort of the rest is history. Emergent was born about 5 years ago. It took, I guess, 9 months for Paul and I to both get our heads around where we wanted to go, and we kicked off the first Chinese Whisperings anthology in February 2009. And since then we've published 6 books, and we have 3 more in the wings waiting to roll out in the next 6 months.
When you talk about the books being collaborative works, what sort of frameworks do you use? What tools do you use to bring this all together over the internet?
Gee, when we first started off in 2009, we really relied just on email. I look at all the things that we use now. We use Submittable for the literary mixtapes, anthologies, everyone submits through that basically so I can't lose the stories. We use Skype, we use Twitter, we use Facebook, we've used Yahoo Groups in the past. We use Google Docs. Then you've got the online platform. So we use the Kindle digital publishing platform, and Lightning Source International, who is our print publisher, also has a digital platform that we submit to. Look, even everything down to text messaging on a telephone, I'd say we use a pretty broad range of digital platforms and social media. As I said, Emergent was born on Facebook chat, so we've been digital natives from the outset.
Would you say that using, in particular, I think perhaps social media is part of the process of actually promoting the projects as well?
Oh, absolutely. As much as we use social networking to find and source the writers and allow them a chance to interact and get to know each other, it's also has been for the last 3 years our major form of promotion and selling, especially through Twitter and Facebook, and to a lesser degree our blogs as well. The thing that we're finding difficult at the moment is we have an amazing network of writers that we know. It's tapping into an amazing network of readers via these social media platforms. So that's kind of where we're now branching away, trying to use social media to connect with readers rather than writers.
Would it be fair to say that you've gone through this process of figuring out how to create content and how to share content, and now you're kind of at the stage where you're trying to figure out how to monetize it a little bit better?
Things change so quickly to keep up with newest, brightest, biggest, flashest thing. We were slow on the uptake for the Kindle Select program. So it launched, I think, in December last year, and we've only just jumped on the boat at the start of this month. So it wasn't so much that we didn't know it existed, we did, but all of our projects have built-in bookstores and e-downloads and all the rest of it. So we actually had to go and dismantle a whole heap of our infrastructure so we could actually enroll our books in Kindle Select, because it's an exclusive agreement with Amazon as distributor for 3 months. So it was kind of weird to have to go back and dismantle everything that we kind of built to sell e-books.
That must have been quite a big decision, though, to take what you've already been doing and take it apart and put everything into Amazon. I mean, what were some of decisions behind that?
The first thing, I guess, it was driven by watching some of our writers who have books and anthologies who had been utilising the Kindle Select program to push their books right up the chart, watching it move from the free charts across to the paid charts and them actually making quite a bit of money. So it was purely a financial decision to try and shift some books. It's kind of bizarre the way Emergent grew, because even though Emergent sort of started at the same time as Chinese Whisperings, all our pilot projects kind of built around it and had fully fledged websites and the rest of it. But the Emergent website is pretty crap as the hub for all these projects. So it sort of came at a time when we were trying to consolidate everything as well. So it was kind of a good swift kick up the bum to decide that no, we were going to close down the individual bookstores on all of our individual project sites and feed them back to a central source, so that people who may come to buy an anthology from Literary Mixtapes, when they're in the bookstore, go, oh, they also produce 100 Stories for Queensland or Chinese Whisperings, or we've got Emma Newman's anthology of short stories. So trying to bring the customer to a place where they can interact with more of our products.
I think it's interesting what you're saying, because, you know, the last interview I did with this guy, Roger Overall, who's a photographer, and he sells a video series online on his website, or on a particular website called Circle of Confusion. And what I think is interesting about what you're saying is that you've kind of chosen not to go down that route of hosting everything on your own websites where somehow you hope you can kind of drag people in, but you're actually kind of taking your content to where you know people are actually going to go in the first place. I mean, Amazon is where everybody buys books these days, basically. Surely that must have been a huge part of the decision as well, that you just think, you know, we've got to go where people are going.
Absolutely. And especially for me, because I live in Australia, so Amazon has pretty much for the life of its business ignored Australia, Southeast Pacific. So I've been a conscientious objector to Amazon for 5 years, or as long as we've been in business. So I don't buy books through Amazon, or I haven't in the past. So making that decision to go Kindle Select and even to have our books listed on Amazon was huge for me, because I think that Amazon are the evil empire. And while everyone's talking about the disintegration of traditional publishing and the freeing up of the market and the stepping down of the gatekeepers and the rest of it, I feel like we're just handing the keys to the kingdom over to Amazon, who are one humongous entity. So for me, it was difficult to kind of go, for the sake of our financial future, that we kind of have to make the decision to throw our lot in Amazon. But having said that, it's for 3 months exclusively. And then we'll probably pull out of it and we'll explore some of the e-options that are available in Australia through the Small Press Underground Networking Community, SPUNK. There's several other e-initiatives that are kicking off in Australia. We're a bit slow on the uptake here. So we're looking at other markets and other avenues to tap into. But as you say, everyone goes to Amazon. So, you know, we had our first freebie promotion through Amazon and managed to get to number 2 on the free charts last Thursday and Friday. Kept from number 1, ironically, by a fantasy book that should not have been in the anthologies category, which was really frustrating. But yeah, everyone goes to Amazon. So, you know, for the time being, so are we. But it's for now and not, but not forever.
Do you think Amazon is turning more into a social media platform than a book-selling platform?
I think Amazon has tapped into the twinkle of social media. I guess any business that wants to stay ahead of the game would be remiss in not trying to build some kind of social media platform into their business model. So I guess that's what Amazon's doing. I know they have thriving forums and the ability to exchange book reviews and that kind of stuff. But I know even that's kind of become a bit of a cesspit between people specifically posting bad reviews and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, old Amazon, as you can tell.
I think they have created a social media platform that involves the selling of books, but I also think you're right in saying that it, by making it a marketplace, of course, it's a free-for-all for everyone. You know, if I'm, for example, a rival publisher to you, there's nothing to stop me going on all your presences on Amazon and elsewhere and actually saying how terrible your books are. They're not terrible books, they're brilliant books. But Mark Rock kind of mentioned it in the interview I did with him, where he spoke about Audioboo is a platform, but they're not in the business to actually censor anyone unless they do anything illegal. And I think Amazon are probably taking the same stance.
It's one of those things that as soon as you make anything public, you actually lose control to a certain degree over what happens.
How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the idea of losing control? Do you have any kind of strategies that you use? For example, if you know someone has gone in and said something bad about one of your books, or, you know, is there anything specific you do to try and combat that?
Well, gratefully, as far as I know, no one said anything bad about our books. It doesn't preclude it from happening in the future. But a friend of mine several years ago, Constantine Markides, who ran Fourth Fiction back in 2009, when he was preparing to roll out his project, which was an online reality TV series for authors, and he said to me, what's going to stop anyone from stealing my idea? I can't afford to patent it, or, you know, copyright and all the rest of it. And I said, well, look, the first thing you can do is you can put it under a Creative Commons license. But secondly, if you think someone's going to steal your stuff, to me, you're putting that intention out to the universe that you want someone to steal your stuff. I said to him, look, don't think about it. Do everything that you can in your power to protect it, but don't create the mentality that someone is going to do bad stuff to me. So I guess I don't focus too much on the potential dramatics that can happen of people writing bad reviews or people purposely going out of their way to interrupt our business or drag our business's name through the through the mud. So focus on the positives.
That's a strategy in itself, just saying, no, we focus on the positive. That's actually your strategy for dealing with it, I think, which I actually think is the right thing to do. You know, I think you could get very sidetracked with trying to figure out what to do and trying to keep that control. I think the key is to keep it positive and let it loose and see what happens.
Absolutely. Though my partner and I do joke between his Shelfari and between Goodreads that sometimes I think the best books are the ones that provoke the greatest contrasts in 2 stars and 5 stars and the rest of it, that they're the books that people really, really love or books that people really, really hate. So, you know, sometimes 1 or 2 stars isn't necessarily the death knell, especially if you've got a lively exchange of ratings and ideas. It shows that there's a diversity of ideas about something, an opinion.
Would you say then that perhaps when it comes to these kind of social media style platforms that are connected with something, in this example books or the selling of books or the promotion of books, that it's about the interaction and the engagement and not so much about the promotion?
I think John Birmingham, when he spoke at the Reader's Symposium here in Brisbane in April last year, said Twitter is not a public loudspeaker. Twitter is open there for communication and for conversation. And also what Seth Godin speaks about in developing and fostering communities around what you create. And I think that that social media provides a level platform for all people to engage on equal terms. Devon Watson and I were speaking a couple of weeks ago about how, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, if you really liked an author, you pen them a letter and you hope that they got it and maybe they might write back to you. Now you can find them on Twitter, send them a tweet, and maybe they might tweet you back. That for the first time ever, we have almost unlimited access to the people who inspire us, who challenge us, our idols and the people that we look up to.
Let's kind of go back a little bit back to the books themselves. What formats do you actually publish in?
Paperback and ebook. And we're hoping that over the course of time we can move those across into audiobooks as well. But I find it interesting that people say, oh, do you do paperback or do you do ebook or do you both? Because for us it's kind of a moot point because we produce both of them and we don't actually see it as paperback or ebook. We actually bundle them together, which is another sort of downside about being on Amazon at the moment. We actually bundle them together. So when you buy a paperback, you also automatically get an e-copy, because we believe that you should have the best type of access to our material as possible. So say you're 2/3 of the way through a book and you have to go away on business or holiday or whatever, that whole dilemma, do I take